for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, June 26th, as the month of June is fast slipping away into the month of July, where here in America, we celebrate Independence Day on July 4th, a day with which we Americans are so obsessed, and which I prefer to de-emphasize in favor of celebrating our interdependence. I'll say more about that next week on our show when our guest will be Jennifer Hines, who we tried to have on the show May 29th, but due to PRN's move, we had to postpone. However, Jennifer will be with us next week, and she'll be speaking about our interdependence with the melting Arctic and the methane monster that is resulting from that melt. It also happens that on this day in the United States, many of us are wildly celebrating the Supreme Court's ruling on the legality of gay marriage in all 50 states. Many of us never believed we would live to see this day, but here it is, and we're ecstatic. And at the same time, we should all be keenly aware that even amid this joy and celebration throughout this past week, thousands of people have been gathered in Charleston, South Carolina, throughout the last 7 or so days to mourn the loss of 9 people who were massacred there by a young white supremacist. Again, reminding us that at the same time that some people are celebrating their hard-won equality, others are deeply grieving the targeting of their race by those who will never have the capacity to recognize the sanctity of all living beings. My heart goes out today to the people of Charleston, and I bow to all of those in human history who have fought for justice for all beings, and for those who have fought for justice for the earth. Today, I'm deeply honored to have with me one of the stalwart veterans of environmental activism in the world. He is, in my opinion, the activist's activist and carries the scars of 30 years of battle for Earth's integrity. He's one of the great elders of the struggle for Earth's integrity. And when I use that word elder, I'm not talking about age as much as I'm talking about wisdom and seasoned experience. I have enormous respect for this man, and I know you will too after you hear his story and feel his commitment to Earth justice. I'm not going to take a lot of time introducing this amazing man, who many of you who spend time on Facebook are probably quite familiar with. I'm talking about Mike Farragon of Edinburgh. He's been schooling me on the correct pronunciation of that town, Edinburgh. So welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Mike.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you for having me on. And I don't think I've ever received such a compliment about my years of activism, such a heartfelt compliment. So thank you very much for that introduction. It's much appreciated.
You're very welcome. It's wonderful to have you on the show. First of all, I want to thank you for starting Extinction Radio and for making me a regular on that show. Mm. And will you just begin by telling us all how people can find and listen to Extinction Radio?
Well, firstly, Carolyn, we're absolutely delighted to have you as a regular on the show. Your contribution provides support, it provides compassion, guidance, and is invaluable, as it helps us kind of maintain a healthy balance, which kind of complements the pretty gruesome and uncomfortable information that we consider it's our duty to put out there. So, you know, at what point do you stop telling the truth? You know, even the mainstream media is starting to wise up, not forgetting that sensationalism sells papers, although I'm sure they're mainly right-wing editors and owners are in a bit of a conundrum at the moment.
Right.
So to answer your initial question, Extinction Radio is a production of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook and is broadcast every Sunday on activatemedia.org. And that's at noon Pacific daytime, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 8 p.m. what I like to call duck time. And why I call it duck time is I don't like using the word UK because we're not really in a United Kingdom over here, so I call it the disunited kingdom. So if I, it's more like a lame duck, actually, our government over here. So it's easier, and probably more importantly, the links to the broadcast and podcast are always up in the pinned post on the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. So if you want to get easy access, that's the best place to find them. And that pin post is up there from Saturday to Wednesday every week. So immediately after Extinction Radio, the show, you can find both links there. Although the direct link to Extinction Radio is extinctionradio.com, where all the podcasts and shows are archived.
Very good. That's a very complete answer. So, Mike, you have a very long history of activism in your part of the world, and I'm wondering if you'd give us some background. Tell us briefly about your childhood, your upbringing, your military boarding school days, and your time at the university.
No, do I have to tell you about my military boarding school days?
well, as much or as little as you like.
Well, they had a big effect on me, so I think that they're worth talking about. The first 5 years of my life was basically spent in a working-class estate in the middle of Edinburgh, of which you got correct, which I'm pleased about, in, you know, a bunch of ticky-tacky houses that all look just the same. My father was in the Royal Air Force, and then after about 5 years, I moved to Aden, which you'll probably know that there's a huge war going on there at the moment. It's in the Yemen. It's just one of the many Middle East conflicts that are going on at the moment, which are absolutely heartbreaking. But I've had traumas in my life, which led me to that long history of activism that you mentioned. And at the age of 9, I was sent to an all-boys military boarding school, no girls, for 9 years. And it was my experiences during this time which provided me with, I suppose, two major episodes of trauma. Which I think I've learned, I've worked my way through and have made me the person that I am today. But those episodes of trauma at the military boarding school were crying my eyes out when my mum left me and my dad left me and they went down the driveway and I was left with 250 boys in a new environment, which I just did not know how to adapt to at all. So I spent the rest of my days at boarding school trying to adapt to that trauma. And that involved becoming a dormitory leader, trying to please my parents in order to get away from the school. I kept writing letters to them, but they kept not replying to the letter saying I wanted to leave. I didn't like it. So I became a dormitory leader, and I learned about leadership, and I learned a little bit about bullying, and I learned about power, and I learned about ego at a very early age. And then I went into senior school, and my power was taken away from me, and I had to spend the rest of my time at the school, 5 years, trying to make friendships built on the back of being a leader or having a position of power and ego. And that was not an easy thing to do. But I did imagine, I did succeed in doing that. You know, I went from being a conformist to being a revolutionary at my time in school, and I ended up playing in a band called Government Property, because we were a government property. I don't think the lecturers knew that the band understood the reason we called ourselves Government Property. I think they were that stupid they didn't realise, so because we played at the school disco. But so then I left school. Played in a band in Edinburgh for 2 years, worked at the Medical Research Council, was trying to find my way in life. I didn't know what this outside world place was, with girls in it, with pubs in it, you know, with this newfound freedom. So I worked at the Clinical and Population Cytogenetics Unit at the Medical Research Council. So if anybody wants to look that up, you can go and look that up. I didn't achieve much there. So on I went to university, still not knowing who I was, what my place in the world was. And I thought, well, what better than to study philosophy, psychology, sociology? I might find out something about which way to turn. And at the same time, I came across a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which listeners have probably know all about, and also a book called The Tao of Physics. I spent a lot of time there getting stoned. I took LSD, and I didn't learn anything apart from how to do that and what was contained in those two books, although I did learn how to pass exams. So I didn't take university seriously at all and left 6 weeks before my final exams. So after that, I spent 6 weeks... I went hitching around Europe, working in various factories, which I suppose taught me a lot about slave labor, capitalism, and homelessness. That was, that's sort of what brought me to learning about social justice anyway. I'm not quite sure where environmental justice took off to start off with. That's basically the first bit of my background before I got involved in my environmental and social justice life.
Well, yes, and I think that leads right into the next question, which is, I believe in the 80s you joined the English Green Party and became involved with Friends of the Earth and also something called community engagement. I'd love to hear more about this time in your life and your budding activism in those days.
Yeah, my budding activism, well, I'm not quite sure where my budding activism sprouted from, but I joined the Green Party when it was actually called the Ecology Party, so that was a long time ago, and I was influenced by, believe it or not, Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature. And also the Ecology Party's Manifesto for a Sustainable Society. I read both of these, and then I was immediately convinced that instead of sitting about doing nothing and having this information in my hand, that I had to go out there and do something about it. And from that moment, I never stopped. But it brings to mind a friend of mine who was called Ron Bailey. He worked for the Green Party, and I asked him a question about environmentalism, and he said, I'm not an environmentalist. I can't answer that question. I'm a campaigner. I'm the guy that licks the stamps. I'm the guy that folds the envelopes. I'm the guy that runs the stalls. I'm the guy that is the tactician, the strategist. I'm the guy that does the work behind the scenes. I'm not the guy that puts myself up there and presents myself all the time, or the learned lecturer who, repeats the same thing time and time again. So it makes it quite easy for him. I'm the guy that actually does the stuff behind the scenes. And that is the kind of guy that I turned into. And I'd been doing it for 30 years. It actually isn't the English Green Party. I was, it's the English, Northern Irish, Scottish and Welsh Green Party at the time. I formed my own party. It was called the Hounslow Green Party. It's an area of London. And I was well known for my activities, and it wasn't sort of so much community engagement in terms of a project or a name of an organization. It was community engagement in terms of my actual activities. So I was well known for my praxis, which is putting thoughts into action. So I became involved in things called can hits. So we used to go around the streets of London picking up all the cans. We're talking about the mid-80s here, picking up all the cans and recycling them. We got a penny a time for doing that. And it helped fund some of our campaigns. So we had newsletters that we put out in the local Green Party. We went knocking on doors. Mid-80s, I was doing that. I was involved in the London Federation of Green Parties. And also the Duck Green Party, and I've explained what Duck is already. At the time, the Duck Green Party, there was no leadership involved. They had co-chairs. I was involved in the debate about leadership, and there was always I was also involved in membership and in rates of membership and activity within the party and the party structure, because the party is still a very middle class party. It's still a very small party in comparison to the other parties, and they only get active at election time. And I was always like the anti-party party guy. So I immediately got a reputation of being a bit of a radical within the party. I saw the party as being the end goal of the party was actually being to dissolve itself because it believed in real localization. But in reality, that is not how it works, because it had an informal hierarchical structure, which it has already, which is probably is much more formal now, and it was subject to the usual big egos and careerists and corruption. So, local decision making was meant to be one of the party's main aims. And sadly, that was something which was pushed to one side because they became part of a political system which is corrupt. They were partly agreed that this was the system that they were going to operate in, and they would pay the subscription and they would go to heaven and they would not be active at all out with election times. They were a political party, and this is how political parties operate. So they were nothing new, they were nothing special, but I stayed with them and tried to change the structure for many years. And in terms of Friends of the Earth, you asked about Friends of the Earth. I was involved with them with environmental audits, carrying out environmental audits for local councils. And at the time, I was working. I worked in residential work, looking after clients of all groups, from people with learning disabilities to old folks. But when I wasn't working, I was a full-time activist. And when I was working, I spent all my time on environmental and social justice campaigning. And not just campaigning, but coordinating, because I've seemed to slip quite neatly into a coordination role. And I remember one comment from my boss, who said he wanted my balls on a silver platter because I was trying to get environmentally friendly products introduced into the council procurement policy. So there you go. That's that was my involvement with the English, Welsh, Northern Irish and Scottish Green Party at the time.
Well, then you got involved with the Scottish Green Party, I believe, after that. And then somewhere subsequently to that, you were involved in a vigil for the Scottish Parliamentary Democracy. Can you tell us about those developments?
Yeah, I mean, I could write a book about those developments. I mean, the Scottish Green Party became independent in 1989. And I was at the independence when the independence motion was passed down at the English, Welsh and Northern Irish and Scottish Green Party at the time when the motion was passed. The pipes were played. It was a very emotional moment. And I decided then that I wanted to come back home to Scotland, which I'd been away from for 15 years because I was missing my home and I was missing my friends. And I was missing my family. So I came back to Scotland, and what I found was a Scottish party in total disarray, a handful of inactive local parties, a lack of funding, and a lack of volunteering. So I came back and spent about a year and a half as full-time office manager. Now, the problem with the Scottish Green Party and the electoral system in this country, in Duck and in Scotland to a certain extent, is that we have a first-past-the-post system. And I suggested to them that rather than just standing at elections and getting 1% of the vote, which is what we normally achieve, then you have to spend £500 a time to stand a candidate at an election, and if you don't get 5% of the vote, that money just goes to the tax man. So instead of doing that, we should expose the electoral system as a radical Green Party, and we should go for a no vote campaign, and we should go for educating the electorate about how undemocratic our first past the post system is, where majoritarianism rules, where minorities are completely excluded. But because the party was so middle class They weren't interested in that at all, and they're so wedded to the current party political system. And you know, they were looking at for careers as well within the Green Party, and they had these egos and stuff which I didn't have. So I was always seen as a bit of a radical in the Green Party. But then 1992 came along. And we had an election, and all the polls were saying, hey, you're going to get a Labour government in, and Labour had promised us that we'd have a Scottish Parliament. So we were all really looking forward to that. But as the recent polls showed in the recent election, polls can be very, very wrong. And we got a Conservative government. And I well remember that night in 1992, in April, when the government was elected, or was it May, that I and a friend of mine were seen on the main BBC News at 9 o'clock burning a Conservative Party poster, because we were angry. We were angry that we didn't get the government. The people in Scotland continually vote for governments that they don't get, because we're outnumbered 10 to 1 by the people down south, and especially by the wealthy people in the south of England. So they vote for Conservative governments. We often vote for Labour governments, but we never get them. So you mentioned interdependence earlier on, and it's a word which I've been using all my life, and it's a word which I'm really keen on, because interdependence is much better than independence, because independence gives you an idea of separation. It leads to then nationalism, and then possibly it can lead on to fascism, which I believe we're in a corporate fascism at the moment. Most countries are. So I would just like to we have a famous Scottish poet called Rabbi Burns. Have you heard of him, Carolyn?
Oh, just a few times.
Just a few times. I just want to read a couple of wee verses from Rabbi Burns.
I would love it.
Well, this one is called Such a Parcel of Rogues in a Nation. It's a Scottish folk song whose lyrics were taken from Rabbi Burns. And in 1707, the Parliament of Scotland signed the Act of Union. And it was basically signed by a bunch of people in the Scottish Parliament at the time. We had our own Scottish Parliament at the time. We signed the Act of Union, but it was a bunch of people who received money for signing this Act of Union. And the Scottish people are sovereign. But the Scottish people were not allowed to vote on this. It was just a bunch of people. So this is what, such figures as, such historic figures as Robert the Bruce and William Wallace were fighting for, and they got sold. They got sold out, basically. So this is what our Rabbi Burns said. Oh, would he, I'll start again. Oh, would ere I had seen the day that treason thus could sell us. My old grey hair had lean in clay with Bruce and loyal Wallace. But pith and power till my last hour, I'll mak this declaration. We're bought and sold for English gold, such a parcel of rogues in a nation. I didn't read that out too well, but I think you got the kind of message there. And also on the green issue, another wee one from Rabbi Burns. It's called Te Amus, and this is the last verse. And this was in the 18th century, and this is about how Rabbi Burns was green. He was a green at heart. And in this verse, this is how it goes. I'm truly sorry, man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. Now that was when he was digging up a field and a little mouse came along and he startled the little mouse, and he said that we have broken nature's social union because of man's dominion. And even in those early years, we had people like Rabbi Burns realizing that, our footprint that we were leaving on this earth was not very positive at all. So, yeah.
Well, Thank you so much for reading him. You know, and it's beautiful as you read him. It just reminded me of present time. And he was way ahead of his time, obviously.
Well, he was way ahead of his time. And sadly, we haven't learned anything from it, because you mentioned the vigil. The vigil was the vigil for a Scottish Parliament and democracy for Scotland. When we heard the election result, and when the burning of the poster took place and was on the BBC News, I led a bunch of people up to the location which was meant to be the Scottish Parliament, which the Labour Party had promised us. And we set up a vigil for a Scottish Parliament, which lasted for 5 years, 24/7. And it had two arms to it. It had a vigil, which was a porter cabin on the street for 5 years, but it also had another arm, which was called Democracy for Scotland, which was liaising with all the political parties, the trade unions, all the social justice organisations, etc. So I was coordinator of Democracy for Scotland and the vigil for 5 years. So I was having meetings with the ex-First Minister of Scotland, who would be called the Prime Minister. Our now First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, was taking notes at the time, but they were careerists. I was never a careerist. I never wanted to stand to be a member of Parliament, because I saw Parliament as being the issue itself. I saw the lack of complete democracy and disempowerment that parliaments provide, and the corporatocracy, basically they're being controlled by corporations and lobbied by corporations all the time. So there is no power at all. We've been completely disempowered, and I believe completely in decentralization, as supposedly the Green Party did. So, I mean, we did many things during those 5 years. We had the biggest march ever in Scotland in 92 for democracy. We were part of the Constitutional Convention, which introduced a new proportional voting system for the Scottish Parliament. So the Scottish Parliament actually, when it was formed, had two votes. I developed this idea with others to have a second vote. Now, the votes are actually carried exactly the same weight, but the posters that we put up on the lampposts said second vote green, which gave people the idea it was like a preferential vote, that they could vote for their main party with their first vote, Labour, the Tories, or the Lib Dems, or whatever, but they could salve their green conscience a little bit by saying, oh, I'll give my second vote to the Greens, because I think they're kind of maybe deserve it, and there's maybe something wrong with the environment. So we ended up getting our first ever Green representative in a parliament in, I'll say, the UK, elected in 1999, and on the back of a campaign which I'd organised, and I was called Field Marshal Ferrigan at the time, because I organised a very comprehensive campaign which covered the whole of Lothian, which is an area which Edinburgh is contained within, covered all of the lampposts which we were allowed to put posters on at the time, and gave us an equal platform with the rest of the parties, saying second vote green. So people, and indeed the media, took up this idea of the second vote being green, and we got people elected on the proportional system which we'd developed with the Constitutional Convention at the time of the vigil.
Very good, Mike. Well, folks, we're talking today here on the Lifeboat Hour with longtime activist Mike Ferrigan, who lives in Edinburgh, Scotland, and who created the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. He also is the founder of Extinction Radio. Now, we're not taking callers this week because I want to devote the entire hour to Mike and the treasure trove of wisdom and organizing experience that he brings to the conversation on catastrophic climate change and near-term human extinction. Moving along in your life now, Mike, you were involved in another amazing project, which involved 6 schools in which you helped develop the program to teach climate change awareness. I'd love to hear about that, as well as about Professor Pongu. And for those of us in the U.S. who have no idea who Professor Pongu is, I would love you to explain all of this to us and tell us what happened in the election with which he was involved.
Okay, well, It's a bizarre. It just shows you how undemocratic our system is. Because in 2003, well, in 1999, I mentioned we had our first ever Green MP or MSP, member of the Scottish Parliament, elected. And 2003, we got seven elected, and really they were basically not listened to because of our majoritarian system. They were just elected, and they had very little say whatsoever. You know, although we did have proportional representation, we still had the majoritarian system within Parliament. Although we had MSPs, they still did not really have a voice. So they were really just speaking to themselves. But quite bizarrely, 4 years later in 2007, we only had two MSPs. And we lost five MSPs. The Scottish Green Party lost five MSPs, but they held the balance of power, right? So
amazing.
The Scottish National Party needed those two Green MSPs to get into power. So they had to negotiate with them as to what they would give them so that the Greens would vote with the Scottish National Party. So what the Greens came up with was something called the Climate Challenge Fund. So this was a fund of something like £10 million at the time. And I took the opportunity of applying for some of this funding. First, I got some funding from the local council, and then I got more funding from the government, from the Climate Challenge Fund. And I applied for £500,000 to set up a project for the whole of Edinburgh, for every school in Edinburgh. But they said to me, no, although my project, I didn't see any holes in it at all. And they said, no, we want a pilot project first. So let's do your pilot project, and then we'll talk about the rest of Edinburgh and potentially the rest of Scotland. And the project was called PIPER, which stands for Parents in Partnership Eco-Representatives. Now, I took advantage with this project in a loophole in Scottish Government legislation. And there was a bill passed by the Scottish Parliament in 2009 called the Parental Involvement Act. Now, I don't know if you have schools in America there, if you have any parental involvement in schools at all, or parents are involved
in
children's education. Mm. Well, you know, they were here, but they were called school boards. And school boards were really stuffy, middle-class type people that sat round tables, thought that they were really important, and made decisions about paths and whether they should have a fence here, or whether people should be allowed to park there, or maybe have some influence in saying who the head teacher was. But this wonderful new Parental Involvement Act allowed us much more power to get involved in our children's education. So we had parent councils, and parent councils were allowed to have subgroups. So I formed an eco subgroup of the parent council in one local school, and then it turned into six local schools, and I ran then the PIPER project and went into all of these schools and did presentations as a penguin to the primary school kids, because I was looking for something to engage the children. Now, I don't know if you people over there have heard of Pingu. Well, Pingu is a very famous cartoon character over here, and I'm his cousin, and I come from another planet. And I was called on the news the intergalactic penguin. So I needed a way to engage primary school kids. And this engaged them with climate change. And it was a very successful project with the six schools that I was working with. And I had an independent report done on the project. And it said how successful the project was at cutting carbon emissions in these large areas. And if anybody wants to find out about the project in detail, they can go to Vimeo and put in Curry, which is C-U-R-R-I-E, primary school, and up will come about a two-hour video of the comprehensive project that I ran, which included not just the presentations, but I stood in the pulpits of two churches, dressed as a penguin and addressed congregations about climate change and sustainability issues. I put in 5,000 DVDs that I'd made into the children's school bags. Now, this was getting a little bit too radical for the government. But so eventually they... you know, I put in another application for another 13 schools. I talked to another 13 head teachers, and they all said, yes, we love this project. We're going to go with this project. But the government made it extremely difficult for me to get any more funding. I decided, well, you know, I really only, Carolyn, get involved in projects that I think are going to have an end result.
Right.
And they're going to achieve results. And this project, and replicable projects as well. And this project was replicable across the whole of Scotland. Because what do you have in what we call communities? What you have are churches, you have pubs, and you have schools. So if you can have a replicable climate change project within communities, and in this instance schools, you can actually cover the whole of Scotland and have a real influence in the whole of Scotland. And not just that, if you do that, you can then transfer it to the whole of England. So that was my vision. But when you have a First Minister in the Scottish Government saying that relentless pursuit of economic growth is his first priority and doesn't realise that, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it, pal, you know, then you're up against it. So I was refused funding, all the kind of bureaucratic, all the stuff I had to fill in, they just refused my funding, they thought I was too radical, I was telling too much truth to the kids, and I got refused funding. So I got so fed up with them that I went to, I refused to fill in the application form because I knew I was going to get turned down, and just at that moment, Occupy Edinburgh started, and I went on to get involved in Occupy Edinburgh.
Well, you know, I'd like to hear about that, but I'm looking at our time, and in the interest of time, I want to sort of skip ahead a bit.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. I'm so glad for this background. I really appreciate it. But I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about the Near-Term Extinction Group on Facebook and Extinction Radio. Maybe you could just spend a couple of minutes briefly, quickly telling us about the movement Eradicating Ecocide and your involvement with that.
Okay. Polly Higgins, who's a good friend of mine, she's an environmental lawyer. I talked to her for the first time yesterday, first time in over a year, actually, and she's going to be interviewed on Extinction Radio, had proposed an amendment to the Rome Statute. And the amendment goes something like this. Ecocide is the extensive damage to, destruction of, or loss of ecosystems of a given territory, whether by human agency or by other causes, to such an extent that peaceful enjoyment by the inhabitants of that territory has been or will be severely diminished. Now, there are four crimes against peace at the moment in the UN, right? And these are the crime of genocide, the crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes of aggression. And what Polly Higgins is doing is she's attempting to add the crime of ecocide to these crimes at the UN, and she's in, you know, and add one to the Rome Statute. So, you know, I could go on more about that if you want, but that is what Polly is attempting to do, and this would enable courts to prosecute, for example, people that get involved in these terrible projects like the tar sands, to prosecute people and corporations for acts of ecocide. And it would give the earth rights, something similar to which Bolivia has introduced in its constitution.
Yes.
This would be worldwide ranging. Now, whether something like this actually stands a chance of being put into practice remains to be seen. But I totally respect Polly's efforts at trying to get this accepted by the United Nations because, of course, you know, everything depends on the Earth's resources and our respect for planet Earth.
Yes.
And, you know, nothing else exists apart from that. We, as I said, we can't have our cake and eat it, and we've eaten most of the cake already, never mind climate change, and, you know, the implications of wars, etc., and nuclear weapons and nuclear power stations and the like. So, yeah, that's a little bit about eradicating ecocide. You can go to eradicatingecocide.com and you can find out a lot more about Pauling's initiative there.
So, Mike, I want to ask you about when you got involved with Guy McPherson's work and when you actually began and why you actually began the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook.
Right. Well, I'd actually planned to give up campaigning about 20 months ago because I put in about 30 years and I've really felt I'd done my shift. But there's a Facebook group called Global Warming Fact of the Day, which I call Global Warming Fact of Yesterday. And it's very much dominated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's science. And they take about 7 years to produce a report. And these people have vested interests as well, as do a lot of, a lot of NGOs, and the Green Party itself, if those people in power who get paid and it becomes their job. So 20 months ago, I said, right, okay, I'm stopping campaigning. And then I saw this group and I started to get into some arguments with the administrators on this group. And I asked them the question, were they in favor of nuclear power? And they could not ask me this. In fact, they brought in a nuclear scientist to actually answer me, and he told me that thorium reactors would be up and running throughout the world in 2016. So that's how much he knew, right? And
right.
Everything would be okay. So I thought, well, this isn't acceptable. Where else is there that people can go? And there was nowhere. So I thought, right, well, I'm going to have to set up the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. And not just
now, why did you decide at that point to call it that? Because you must have encountered Guy by that time.
Yeah, Guy was like the icing on the cake for me. I had this little red devil in the back of my mind for 30 years, which was coming forward. There's a lot of displacement activity going on. I had a lot of hopium, which was getting less and less and less and less. And I encountered people like Paul Beckwith, Sam Carena, Robert Scribler, Guy McPherson, and they put the icing on the cake. And I think he coined the term near-term human extinction. So I just nicked that from him and set up a near-term human extinction with the emphasis here on support group, because it's okay giving out the message about how bad things are, but if you don't provide support along with it, which you do on Extinction Radio, Carolyn, and that's why you're so important for that show. If you don't provide the support to go along with it, then it can create problems for people, and I'm sure a lot of listeners who follow near-term human extinction or follow climate change will realize they can create a lot of problems, personal problems. So there was need for a support group.
And so what kind of support do you actually offer on that group? I mean, I know this, the answer to this, but a lot of our listeners don't.
Well, we have a fantastic group of admins who keep a watch on it 24/7, right? And if you look at the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model, the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. If you look at all of these, people come to the group in different stages, and they vacillate between these stages. So we try and offer support. We don't offer professional support, but we offer support in terms of being compassionate human beings, in terms of providing a safe space for them, and in terms of being a respectful place. So we have 3,300 members now on the group, and I must give a shout out to our members as well, who respect our guidelines, which are necessary, and also we have no discrimination at all. So our group is totally inclusive of all religions, beliefs, spiritual beliefs, race, sexual orientation, you name it. So Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And you know what I notice from your group is that some other groups have sprouted out from that, like Near Term Extinction Love and like Whistling in the Dark, which is pretty much for parents and families. And so it's great to see these different support groups around this issue coming forth on Facebook.
I think we cover all of those areas, to be quite frank, and there's that is a whole other show to explain where, I mean, Whistling in the Dark turned up as an adjunct to the near-term human extinction support group originally because we had some people coming on who weren't being too complimentary about people having children. We protect people's rights and respect people's rights to have children, even in these end times, and to have these personal choices. So we needed a family-friendly group. So Mike Shouldis and Nina Parker, who run that group, actually set up the group in consultation with myself, and it's a great little group, and it's a family-friendly group.
Yes, it is.
So you can go there. But a lot of the other groups were set up on the back of people going in a huff with the near-term human extinction support group and breaking the guidelines and being rather abusive and stuff. So sadly, when we should be cooperating, we're in competition at times. I do see some benefits in having other groups set up. Without a doubt, I see what you're getting at. But the groups are actually formed because people went off in a huff because they couldn't stick to the guidelines in the group, and they were quite abusive, to be quite honest with you. But you know, people go through anger. We have our guidelines. If they break the guidelines, we try and be as nice with them as possible. We speak to them in PMs, and you know, 99 out of 100 times they respect that and they get back to us and they say, yes, I'm really sorry, and everything is sorted out. But there's just that one time where somebody abuses admins, gets carried away, and then they go off in a huff, and they set up near-term human extinction support group. So a lot of them have come on the back of that, I'm afraid to say, although there is some merit in having these separate groups, I do admit.
So when did you decide that you wanted to start Extinction Radio? It appears that that audience has grown dramatically. When and why did you decide to create it?
In some ways I wish I hadn't, because I spend most of my week now doing Extinction Radio, and our audience, yes, is increasing. And I came up with this idea that instead of just having this sort of normal format of a kind of interviewer, that we could maybe do something a bit more mixed up and a bit more varied and comprehensive, which actually leads into which makes it a longer program. But a program that has lots of different segments. So we have weekly interviews with yourself. We have with Paul Beckwith, with Guy McPherson, and we have a main interview of the week. We had Dar Jamal on last week. We've got Mimi Gurman on this week. We've got Andrew Harvey booked for July. We've got Nafiz Ahmed scheduling us in. But it's Extinction Radio is a lot more besides. We have, you know, permaculture updates, we have minimalist living tips, we have gallows humor, we have poetry readings, we have our dispatch from the end of scene, we have updates from Down Under, and we even have a Sam Karana editorial. So it's a different kind of radio station, if you like, a different kind of production, but I assure you it takes a lot of work to put that together, and as producer of the show it takes up most of my week.
Well, we're so glad that we have it. You know, I love the variety of it and the way you're mixing things up and making it very comprehensive. I just love it, and I wish you all well, and I hope we all go on for a long time doing this Extinction Radio thing, because it's hard work for you, Mike, and it's, I think, very, very important work in the world and fun for those of us involved.
Yeah. I think it is. But I think people have got to stand up to the plate in these end times. They really do have to stand up to the plate and be counted and do the campaigning work and do the work on the ground, set up the support groups, do what you do in terms of your webinars, in terms of the books that you write, in terms of getting the message out there, in terms of the face-to-face support. Because it's okay being on Facebook and doing a little comment, but it's a lot different, I can assure you, actually folding leaflets and getting out there, knocking on people's doors. And, you know, it's a lot different. And when the grid goes down, which inevitably will do, and there will be a last episode of the Lifeboat Hour and a last episode of Extinction Radio, we need support.
Yes.
And we need that support in our communities. And I know that's something that you yourself and Peter Melton are interested in doing, and we may talk about that in the future and get something together around those lines. But, that is really important. And I think people have really got to stand up, be compassionate, live in the now, and help each other and support each other. And that is how they can provide service. I've been trying to provide that service for 30 years. I'm extremely tired. So if there's anybody out there that wants to help with Extinction Radio, wants to help with desktop design, wants to help be an admin on the near-term human extinction support group, just get in touch, because we need people to help and to do stuff.
And they would get in touch with you by sending you perhaps a private message on your page, Near Term Human Extinctions, and Mike Ferrigan, Ferrigan, a private message about that.
That is right. They would get in touch, absolutely no problem at all. Or they could even post something up on the group saying, I'd like to help with this, and we'd see it, and we'd get in touch with them. Because it's really important that we do have, we do spread the workload, and people could get burnt out. I was burnt out 20 months ago before I started it, but it was something I could not avoid doing, because, as I said before, at what point do you stop telling the truth? And in these end times, we don't just have to tell the truth, but if we're going to tell the truth, we have to provide the support to back that truth up as well. And that's why I'm so pleased that somebody like yourself is on Extinction Radio. And that can be found at extinctionradio.com.
And on the Facebook pages, you always put up the link to the previous show, correct?
Yeah. The link is up for 5 days. So we advertise Extinction Radio. And it's on the pinned post, which is the top post. We advertise that on the Saturday, and it stays up there. And that's activatemedia.org is where you hear the radio station. Then we change it to extinctionradio.com is where you hear the podcast. So really, there's only one stop you have to go, and that is a near-term human extinction support group. So anybody that's listening, go along, join the group, and I think you might enjoy yourself and find that there's a lot of support there, and it's not all doom and gloom. We have quite a lot of fun on the group and on Extinction Radio as well. You probably know Benjamin the Donkey, Carolyn?
Yes, oh yes.
And so, that's the sixth stage of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's model, and it's called Gallows Humor, and Benjamin the Donkey does a wonderful job with his limericks of doom.
Yes, he does, actually.
He does.
I like them very much.
Yes.
Well, I really want to thank you, Mike, for being on the show today. You can find Mike Ferrigan on Facebook. You can find his individual page. And you can also find the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. And you can find Extinction Radio, all on Facebook. And he has just told you the other links for finding those places. I'm so pleased to have had you on the show, Mike, because you are truly a veteran in earth activism and so many other forms of activism. And, I bow to you for giving so much time at this point in your life. You're already burned out with so many things, but you're taking on these additional projects. And I'm so pleased that you're doing this. We really need your work.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And, you know, it makes all the difference in the world when you get gratitude and appreciation, the like of what you've shown to me in the words that you've just said and in your introduction. And it gives me inspiration to continue. So thank you very much for those heartfelt words. Really appreciate it. And thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And with the Lifeboat Hour, we always post the archive. We post it usually over the weekend. And so you can just go to the Progressive Radio Network and the different shows, and you will find the archive for today. I think it will probably be up this afternoon. I'm not sure. But I'd like everyone to join us again next week when my guest will be Jennifer Hines, H-Y-N-E-S, Jennifer Hines, creator of the Arctic Methane Monster YouTube presentation that has gone viral on YouTube and in other places. Jennifer's going to talk with us not only about the creation of that presentation, but also her personal, emotional, and spiritual responses to catastrophic climate change. So we look forward to your being with us then. Thank you, Mike Farragan. Thank you, Lifeboat Hour. Thank you, Progressive Radio Network. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.